There's two other persons that's going to assist me. It's Advocate Lydian Clark and Advocate Maxibuela. So I will start immediately if you allow me.
Yes, you can start. Yeah, you can start, and good morning.
Mr. Chairperson, thank you. Mr. Chairperson, I just want to ask that the documents be hosted from your side. Our network is extremely low at the department. If I do that, we're probably going to break up every now and then, if that is possible.
Okay. Mr. Mtrenjani, can you fly the document from your side?
Chairperson?
Mamfuke.
Would you check your message and then you can respond to me? Thank you.
On the phone?
Yes, please.
Okay, on your phone. Let me check it. Okay.
Thank you. I'll proceed. The first proposed amendment is the name of the bill. I propose that it must read the Domestic Violence Act Amendment Bill. I think if you amend a specific act, the bill that amends that act must cite the bill that you amend or the act you amend in full, and then just add amendment bill. If we can go to down. Previously I did made comments. It is indicated in blue. The new proposals in the document that was sent off to the persons is mainly in red. The next amendment is on page 4, if we can go down. And that relates to clause 2, it's the definition clause. I propose amongst others that the definition of Children's Act be inserted due to the fact that it is referred to amongst others in sexual abuse, physical abuse, as well as clause 5 of the bill. The next discussion relates to the definition of coercive behavior. The current definition that is portrayed there is the one as is portrayed in the bill. There's a suggestion that intimidation be removed therefrom, due to the fact that intimidation is dealt with as an act of domestic violence in its own right. At this stage, I'll ask the Lean just to explain a comment on the bill, especially insofar as it relates to this definition. The Lean, are you there?
Robert, sir, before you proceed, are you going to first take us through the document, which might take us long, or are we going to comment as you go along? For instance, we start with the definition that you are proposing in the Children's Act, and to see if other members are happy with it, so that we know that each area that has been dealt with, we know that we have processed it. Or are you just going to first go through the document before you go, you come back to the areas for discussion?
Mr. Chairperson, it's probably better if we take comments as we go along, so that you don't miss something or skip something. So yes, let's take comments as we go on.
I thought so. So let's go to the definition. Let's go to the first one. Let's go to the definition. Members, what what is your comment on the use of the Children's Act of 2005 as a definition?
Mr. Chair, may I speak?
Honorable Kajabach.
Thank you. I agree with the insertion of the definition, that's fine. But I have a question on the second definition, please, when we get to it.
Okay, no, we will give you a chance when we get to it. What is the view of other members on the definition of the Children's Act?
Chair, right here.
Honorable Swart.
Just to indicate, I have to leave for the WIPS meeting, but we'll try to join, rejoin. My apologies, but I'm in agreement with that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Swart.
Hi, Chair.
Honorable Yako.
Thank you. I'm also in agreement with the Children's Act.
Okay. So, are there any...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, thanks very much, Chair. I'm also in agreement, particularly that the child is defined in the Children's Act as a person who's under 18 years. So it would not have been legally correct for us to bring a definition that is inconsistent with that particular. It would have caused legal confusion. So I agree with the definition, Chair. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. Can you go to the next one? Honorable Breitenbach, you said you want to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Robertson. Please forgive me if this question is dealt with elsewhere. I've been out of action a bit, so I haven't fully read the document. Under coercive behavior, I don't see any referral to behavior such as grooming. Is it dealt with elsewhere? Because that is coercive behavior, it is just of a very subtle nature. But I do think that grooming needs to be dealt with. So if it is somewhere else, that's fine. If not, can we talk about putting it in here?
Thank you very much, Honorable Breitenbach. Mr. Robertson? Mr. Robertson?
Chair, may I add something?
Okay, Honorable Yako.
Thank you so much. I also had a concern with the coercive behavior and how it is written there that it amounts to, like all these words amounts to domestic violence in their own right, because coercive behavior is also really quite broad. So there's different types of coercive behavior. Maybe if you could define coercive behavior in a way that we would then understand the actual concept of coercive behavior in all its rights, in all its forms, and then we would agree it. Because it says abusive conduct, acts of force, but it's not very broad.
Okay, yes. Honorable Mfuke?
I would agree that what Honorable Breitenbach was saying, that let us say, get from Mr. Robertson to explain, then we can take it up from there. I hear Honorable Yaku, but I'm interested in engaging after we get what he's saying.
No, thank you very much. We're still trying to get hold of Mr. Robertson. Mr. Robertson? We seem to have lost Mr. Robertson. Is there anyone from the team who has been listening?
And yes, good morning.
Yes, Ms. Clark.
Good morning. Sorry, Honorable Chairperson. It's Deline from the Law Commission. I could maybe respond and perhaps just address the comments that are in the sidebar. And that just relates to the definition as it has been as proposed, that it is including enough of the standalone definitions and acts of domestic violence. So, for example, the proposal is to remove the word abusive and acts of force and intimidation. The reason for that is that coercion is primarily a manner of persuading a person, either by threats or by force, and it is an open definition, so it should include any kind of coercive behavior. So in terms of the proposal that's been put forward, the suggestion is to define it as coercive behavior means any conduct or pressure intended to cause or which has the effect of causing a complainant to act, not to act, or to be subjected to certain acts against his or her will. And the suggestion is also to take out the word undue in front of pressure. And the reason for that is that, particularly in the police comment, is that it's difficult to define when it is undue pressure, what is undue and what is not undue pressure. So if one just says that it's conduct or pressure, it makes it easier to interpret and to apply. And then in terms of the removal of the word related person, the related person is not well placed here as the coercion is applied to the complainant. And the coercion may include acts that are meted out against a related person. For example, I will coerce you to do something, and if you don't do it, I'll beat our child, for example, which will mean the pressure is placed on the person to act in a particular way. I hope this is assisted.
Thank you very much, Ms. Clark.
Mr. Jefferson, can you hear me now?
Yes. You're back, Mr. Roberts.
Sorry, network. I did listen to the explanation of Ms. Clark regarding whether grooming is included in the definition. It's not specifically included, I suppose. It is better placed under sexual abuse, which is dealt with elsewhere or low on. Sexual abuse is another form of domestic violence that has been identified. And in the definition of sexual abuse, reference is made, among others, to offences in the Sexual Offences Act. If it relates to a child, sexual abuse will include, among others, grooming. Thank you.
Honorable Breitenbach, can we address that issue when we deal with that particular
section? Certainly, thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Liako, is the definition, as explained by Ms. Clark, covers you?
I think coercive behavior for me it is really broad. And as someone said in the comments, it can be passive. It doesn't have to be aggressive, such as grooming. So you wouldn't know if it's going to happen or if it's happening. So you'd find out later that actually, in hindsight, I was groomed. So I think I will go with Honorable Breitenbach and just wait for the part that speaks about that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Roberts, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Next one.
Furthermore, there is other definition that is proposed for coercive behavior. And in terms of this definition, coercive behavior means violence or threatened violence towards a complainant or a related person, damage to property or threats to damage to property belonging to the complainant or related person, or any pattern of abusive behavior towards a complainant. Which is then qualified, which is intended to exert undue pressure on a complainant to act, not to act, or to be subjected to certain acts against his or her will. This is just as the third alternative, which may be considered by the committee when they finally instruct us to finalize the bill. Is there any comments on this proposal?
Can you reread the first one and the second one again? And we can see whether is there a need, or we can see whether there is any overlap, or is there a need maybe to find a fusion of the two as the third option. Can you read the first and the second one together?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. If the slide can just show the first definition on page 5, that is coercive behavior, which is currently currently defined as any conduct or pressure intended to cause, which has the effect of causing a complainant to act, not to act, or be subjected to certain acts against his or her will. The second proposal, we define coercive behavior as any pattern of abuse, coercive behavior towards a complainant that is intended to exert undue pressure on a complainant to act, not to act, or be subjected to certain acts against his or her will. Ms. Clark has got a criticism against the use of the word any pattern. And then the third one I did read, where coercive behavior means mainly violence or threatened violence, damage to property or threats to property that is relates to a complainant or a related person. And the third paragraph is any pattern of abusive behavior towards a complainant, which is kind of all-inclusive, and then it's qualified, which is intended to exert undue pressure on a complainant to act, not to act, or to be subjected to certain acts against his or her will. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, having heard the various definitions, what is your comment?
May I speak, Mr. Chair? Thank you. Mr. Chair, I don't really like the word undue. I can see, as a prosecutor, I can see so many pitfalls with undue, what will be undue, what will be viewed as undue, and you could probably spend days arguing that, just that concept. I think pressure is fine, just pressure. Any pressure in this regard should be regarded as undue in any event. So I would prefer not to have undue there. And then I would just like to take up the point of the Honourable Yako with regards to coercive being wide. Again, as a prosecutor, I would rather have it wide so that you could consider each case on its merits, and if it fits in there, then it fits in there. As soon as you start defining it more narrowly, then the interpretation would be that anything that's not in is out.
Mm.
And you may find yourself with a circumstance that doesn't fit in there, but it is coercive. Mm. But because it hasn't been defined, it will be very difficult to get the court to extend the definition to cover it.
Yes.
So I don't know if I'm making myself clear. So as a prosecutor, I would rather be able to argue that something is undue and argue it on the fifth than be faced with a problem of what's in the act is what is regarded as undue, and anything that's not in is not regarded as coercive.
Yes, coercive, yes. So you're much more covered by the first option.
Yes.
May I comment here? Sorry, Honourable Breitenbach.
Yes, let's first finish with Honourable Breitenbach.
I'm done, thank you, Chair.
Okay, Ms. Honourable Yako.
Yeah, Honourable Breitenbach, she makes a valid point. Also, she confuses me where she says that she wants to remove the word undue pressure on a complainant, because it could be subjective to the complainant, whether what that is undue or not. And she keeps mentioning what undue is, which is broad. So why remove it then if it's a basis of an argument to say exert undue pressure on a complainant to act? If the word undue is the basis of the argument.
I'm sorry, I may have misused the word. I meant I was referring to coercive, but undue, again, limits. What is undue? You could, in a court situation, you could spend literally days arguing about what undue is. Whereas if you just have pressure, in my view, pressure in this regard is already wrong. When you want to add in undue, then you've got to, it's like, sort of, what is undue? How much pressure must there be before it's undue? And is less than undue pressure acceptable? I don't think so. So I just think it should be pressure with no undue.
May I comment, Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry, but I just want to say, I mean, undue could be no. Undue could be don't. Undue could be stop. Undue could be anything. So I think undue is in itself as broad as can be because it's subject to the complainant, which makes the complainant to act. So I'm not sure if we have another word for undue that would then make Honorable Breitenbach comfortable with the word. But for me, undue makes sense because for me, undue could be anything from a silent word of no to a broader word of whatever, you know, in terms of coercive behavior. I could say, no, I had said no, and I was coerced. I had said stop, and now I was coerced. So I don't know. I'm confused.
But if I understand Honorable Breitenbach, is the use of the two words together, undue pressure. Her argument is that pressure, when applied, would suffice. Then when you put the word undue, then you are going in an operative way in court, you're going to run into problems, especially for the state. So for her, if I understood her correctly, is that there's no necessity to put the two words together, undue and pressure. And the word pressure alone would suffice. Am I correct, Honorable Breitenbach?
Yes, Mr. Chair, you understood me correctly. I think pressure sufficiently covers it and allows more opportunity to argue on the merits, on the facts and the merits of each particular case. And undue would be limiting in that regard.
Thank you very much. Honorable Yago?
No, Chair, I think I will leave it. I mean, I can't argue law with the prosecutor. So I think I will leave it. Yeah, it's just a concern that I had. I thought I would just put it on record that for me, it's undue makes sense. But I mean, I won't argue with Honorable Breitenbach. I think it's fine. If the committee agrees, then that's fine. That can be removed.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson.
Yes.
There's three definitions.
For now, Mr. Robert, tentatively, we would say we are going to use the word pressure, but we are not making definite decisions for today. We will still come back, maybe both. In fact, maybe all honorable members, because it's not an issue of Honorable Breitenbach and Honorable Yago, are going to think about it, whether putting the word undue pressure would add any significance to the case against the domestic violence, and or whether just putting the word pressure alone does suffice. We will still come back to it. But tentatively for now, let's put the word pressure.
Chair,
Wilma Neo Dukin also. Mam Noma Temba, followed by Dr. Nivo Tasson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was just, you know, sometimes the people that are with us here, they are sending some messages here on the chat. If you can also sometimes keep on checking the because I see the somebody has just sent Claudia send the definition for undue And it says here it's unwarranted or inappropriate because of excessive or disproportionate. So when we go for a break for us to think about that, we must also go to check the definitions of even the pressure. What is the definition of pressure? What is it? So that we can be able to make a very conclusive a response and conclusion on that matter. Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to note that one. Thank you.
Thank you. Before I allow Dr. Nibot's presence, it's quite a difficult matter, Honorable Chair, because the rules of the House, I think they did not cover this aspect. Ordinarily, if we were sitting in Cape Town as a committee, you would not have a situation where you have members of the public just sending messages in that way and those messages being considered. And because generally the time for public comments is over. Because when we adopted those rules for virtual meeting, I think the Rules Committee would still need to apply itself. We have not really been applying a restriction on it. But I do think that members can read those messages. They are there. They do help. But they should not interrupt the proceedings of the meeting, because they can be interpreted as amounting to an extension of public comments by the people who are part of the meeting. I think until the Rules Committee deals with it, I think we never anticipated the use of virtual platforms. We will take a less restrictive approach. Members can look at those messages, but it must be members who raise those issues as their own in the meeting. I hope we take that in the spirit it is meant to.
Thank you, Chair. I understand. I hear you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Nibot Dawkins.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to everyone. I would just like to say I do agree with Honorable Breitenbach because I can just imagine two lawyers in court fighting over the term undue, and when the abuse became undue, and then the victim has to sit and listen to all of this, and you know feel that she was pressured, she was abused, while people are arguing about the word. I think pressure is pressure, and that is it. But I do want to request that sentence just needs to be the full sentence, the full clean sentence later when we get to that stage to make it easier for reading, just to highlight that aspect so that we can just read it in the context of what we just said. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nibot-Dawkins. I think, as I've said, tentatively we agree with the word pressure for now. Can we move to the next one?
Mr. Chairperson, maybe before we move on, since I was offline for a while, the word pattern in the second and third definition is also something that may be problematic. What is a pattern? Is it one conduct, one instance, two instances, three instances? That is also a limiting and vague concept that probably need to be addressed, and it can probably also be taken out of the definitions. Okay. I'm going to move on. That is to the definition of complainant. It's on page 6. If you can move down, please. Okay. In this discussion on this page, I point out that a complainant is defined as a person who has been in a domestic relationship with the respondent and who is subject to an instance of domestic violence. And according to the definition of complainant, a child is also part of that definition. It's a child in the care of the complainant. The effect of the definition is that domestic violence must be committed against the complainant or a child before the complainant can apply for a domestic violence interdict. And this is must be evaluated against the inclusion of a related person in the various instances of conduct that amounts to domestic violence. I did point out previously that there may be some problems if we do include a related person in all the various conducts that that amounts to domestic violence. And that is mainly to the fact that a complainant is to an extent granted the power to apply for an interdict if domestic violence is committed against a related person. I do point out in paragraph B that section 4.3 of the Domestic Violence Act do provide that a complainant may apply for a protection order on behalf of another person, but then with the consent of that person, or where the court is of the opinion that a person cannot give consent. So to an extent, if we keep a related person and all the definitions of domestic violence, we actually do extend the ambit of the complainant's right to apply for a domestic violence interdict. In paragraph C, I do point out that in certain instances, this may be something that can be looked at due to the fact that many persons in a domestic relationship either do not apply for the interdict, but you leave the option open that complainant or other family member can apply on behalf of such a person. The wide ambit of the definitions of domestic violence must also be considered against the criminal and related matters amendment bill, which was dealt with by the committee, where offences against a related person may now amount to an offence against a person in a domestic relationship, and which result in stricter bail conditions, even minimum sentences, etc. So there's two proposals how we can deal with this aspect. First option is to consider domestic violence against a related person as domestic violence where the complainant is afforded the opportunity to apply for an interdict on behalf of such a person. Other provisions of the bill need to be amended to accommodate that. Or the second option is to provide for domestic violence against a related person where it causes harm to a complainant as a special category of domestic violence. And this will also give rise to the amendments of certain definitions. Most of the amendments proposed give effect to option two, namely we only deal with domestic violence or any harm against a related person as an instance.
Sorry, Mr. Robert, so yeah, can you ensure that we see option two?
because you don't move this life. Yeah. Okay, so you can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The second option is to deal with domestic violence against a related person as a special category of domestic violence, and it is recognized as a category of domestic violence where it causes harm to a complainant. And obviously, the various definitions where reference is made to related persons may need to be amended to remove related person. And as proposed in a further category of conduct, a new category of domestic violence need to be created. And the proposals give effect to the second option mainly. And I will deal with the extent of such amendments when we go down. I must also then refer again to coercive behavior, namely the last proposed definition of coercive behavior, where there is specific reference to certain conduct against a related person which causes harm against a complainant. That is also made to accommodate the concerns that is raised here. The definition of controlling behavior is amended mainly to omit a related person from the definition. That is to give effect to option two. There's also a new proposed definition of controlling behavior. If you can go to the next page, please.
Mr. Roberts, I think before you move to the next page, because I think you're going to give us too much, let's first go to that definition of complainant. Let's go step by step. Yes. Members, what is your view? I'm dealing with both the definition, which would encompass the two proposed options. Mr. Roberts, you said option two is more in line with the criminal and related matters, is that correct?
Mr. Chairperson, to a large extent, it will limit the category of persons against whom offences may be committed. As explained in paragraph B, currently a related person is defined as any member of a family or a household of a complainant, or any other person in close relationship with the complainant. One must take into account that, let's say, the complainant and the respondent do not live together, and the complainant marries somebody else. A new husband will then qualify as a related person for all the various conduct that are defined as domestic violence. And even the child, or a new child, or the family of a new marriage partner may be considered as persons in a domestic relationship. And it's my submission that it extends it very wide. The narrow one is more or less, well, let me rather say, is more in line with what we aim to achieve in the Criminal and Related Matters Amendment Bill. That is mainly to protect a family or a household and the people in the family or household. critique is that if we expand it so wide to include persons in a close relationship, it may cause problems for the implementation of the criminal and related matters amending bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And surely we wouldn't want a situation where we pass the, because we have already voted on the criminal and related matters amendment bill. We wouldn't want to have a law and other related law contradicting it.
That is correct, Mr. Chairperson.
Hello, speaking.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I just said I agree with you.
Yes, so let's stick to what we have already passed so that there is consistency, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Something that is not dealt with in this document, which may also be considered in finalizing this bill, relates to the reference in the Criminal and Related Matters Amendment Bill to an offense against a complainant. One must look at the definition of a domestic relationship, which amongst others include persons that merely live together, or even a family member that is not necessarily part of the household. It can be a family member where there's no close relationship between the family member and the respondent. In a future document that I will prepare, I will include this aspect. My submission is we must try to narrow it down and probably insert a definition of an offense against a person in a domestic relationship in the domestic violence bill, to ensure that we can specify first the offenses that may be committed and to restrict its over broadness. That's also something that needs to be considered. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I'm going to move along to controlling behavior. That's on the next page. I already dealt with the first definition. There's a second proposed definition, and it's defined as to mean a pattern of behavior towards a complainant that is aimed at making the complainant dependent on or subservient to the respondent, and which conduct includes isolating him or her from sources of support, exploiting his or her resources or capacities for personal gain, depriving him or her of the means needed for independence, resistance or escape, or to regulate his or her everyday behavior. It's do include various of the other elements in the previous definition. What is instead is again a pattern of behavior towards a complainant. And then the new insertion is that of conduct that is aimed at making the complainant dependent on or subservient to the respondent. Is there any comments on this?
So is there a need to include the word pattern when you have already went into detail to define what the behavior is in the contract?
Mr. Chairperson, pattern, I did indicate pattern is a problematic word and it can be omitted from the definition.
Okay. Members, Honorable Greidenbach.
Thank you. I agree with Mr. Robertson. I think it should be removed.
Okay. Other members?
No, I also agree, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's move.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. New definition is proposed, and that is the definition of communication. There's a new option of harassment, and the new definition of communication relates to the new definition of harassment, which is conduct that is regarded as domestic violence. And the definition states that communication means anything that is used to impart information or ideas and includes a letter, text, photo, video recording and audio recordings. One must differentiate between a communication, the definition of communication, and a definition of electronic communication. It's probably better if I do explain that later when I deal with the new option of harassment. So we can probably discuss the definition there and refer back to it when I deal with that. Damage to property, a new proposed insertion in the definition of property is that of corporal or incorporeal property. Just to clarify that it's not necessarily a car that can be damaged or a house or a chair, but it's also something like a computer program or anything inside the space. It's to broaden the definition of the damage to property to also things that is not visible or things in cyberspace. If one look at various domestic violence legislation, recognition is given to the fact that incorporeal property is also something that can be damaged to harm a complainant. Going to stop there for comment on this definition.
So can we, we're now on damage to property, because I thought that you said on communication we'll come back to it when we have dealt with also electronic communications. Now we have moved to damage to property. Members, any comments? And now, can you proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Going to move to the other definitions of damage to property. Proposal one was previously discussed. I do indicate here that harming of a threat to harm of a household animal or other animal can be dealt with under the definition of damage to property, but it can also be more conveniently be dealt with under the conduct of domestic violence defined as emotional, verbal, or psychological abuse. Proposal 2 was discussed previously in the committee. A new definition, Proposal 3, is proposed. Thank you. And the new definition defines damage to property as the willful damaging or destruction of property or threats to damage or destruction of property belonging to, which is possession of, or under control of the complainant, or in which the complainant has a vested interest. This is just a third option that can be considered when the committee finalized the bill. Is there any specific comment on the third proposal?
Any comment, members? Not at this stage. Honorable Jala?
I think on this one, I think the issue of in which, okay, or B, option 3B, where it says in which the complainant has vested interest. I just want to find out from Mr. Dupree that that statement, does it cover the, for example, these people are staying together. Remember in the in marriage, we have different types of marriages. The marriage that not the one in community property, the one with you come with your thing, does it?
International contract.
International contract.
Yes, where this thing belongs to this person. In fact, let me say out of a community of property, for example, this person, we are staying together in this house. Obviously, this belongs to you, but we are sharing it as we are staying together. And this person damages this. And it even if it belongs to him, but because of we are staying here, we have children together, and if he damages this thing, it affects the family, even the children themselves, because remember, children are both of us, even if we are out married in out of a community of property. So I just want to find out in that case, how is the situation will be handled? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Mr. Clark will also assist with the answer in this regard. A vested interest goes beyond mere ownership or control of a property. My submission that where people stay together and there's an anti-nuptial contract and the house belongs to the respondent, but the complainant also lives there, the complainant will actually have a vested interest in everything in the house. She will have a vested interest. It's quite a broad concept. So it extends to anything where a complainant can prove that it probably contributes to a well-being in a domestic relationship. Ms. Clark, are you there? It seems to be...
Yes, I am. There. Sorry.
But yes...
I am here.
Just regarding vested interests, can you just elaborate on what I said?
Yes, thank you. With your permission, Chairperson, what I'd just like to add is the manner in which the definition has been proposed now means that the complainant doesn't have to prove ownership, which is often a contested issue. A respondent might punch something or break something next to the complainant and it's not her property, and she may not have recourse if she can't prove ownership. So the manner in which it's framed now is possession or under the control. And then in terms of damaging his own property, because often respondents are very manipulative and they'll try and skirt around the law. So when they damage, if he were to damage his own car, for example, or to damage his own door by punching it, what would happen is, if you look at the definition of emotional abuse, that would then be factored in under that definition. So I would suggest that both of them get read together, but it would cover all of the possible behavior that could be meted out towards the complainant. I hope this helps.
It does, Ms. Clark. Members?
Honorable Newhart Griffin has her hand up, Chair. Thank you very much, Chair. One question related to vested interest. Vested interest. Sorry, interpreter, just clarifying. Will there be a definition of vested interest? As you have both just explained. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Clark and Mr. Roberts.
Chairperson, sorry. What I'd like to just say is that the proposal is to remove the vested interest so that one does not have to prove the vested interest. The proposal is to now say that if it's in the possession or under the control of the complainant. So one is then removing the very vague area or contested area of vested interest in proving that the person has ownership in the actual belonging.
Mr. Chairperson, regarding Proposal 3, where vested interest is included in addition to possession or under control of a complainant, I don't think it's necessary to define a vested interest. Obviously, if you don't define a specific word in legislation, it must be given the ordinary dictionary meaning. And I think it's quite clear what a vested interest is in the context of Proposal 3, namely it's in addition to everything else that is already included in Proposal 3. So it will include a mere interest in the property, which may include, amongst others, the use of property. Thank you.
Chairperson? Chairperson? Is Chairperson lost or it's us?
I can actually hear you. I think Chairperson.
Honorable Jala.
Excuse Chair. I think I was...
Yes, my apologies. I was omitted.
Okay, Chair, no problem. I wanted to agree with Mr. Dupree. I think for now, let's not remove that or in which the complainant has vested interest. I think it covered the question that I wanted to know in terms of if this thing does not belong to me, but we all benefit as a family. I think for me, for now, let's not remove it, Ms. Black. And your respect for now, let's just leave it as it is. Thank you, Chair.
So in addition to the under the control of the complainant, we also said in which the complainant has a vested interest.
Yes, let it stay like that. I don't know how they will work in terms of wording, but that vested interest, I like it. I'm not sure if other honorables will come with something different, but for now I'm covered. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Ms. Clark, you are the one who raised an objection.
Chairperson, it was originally like this. The submissions that we received just said that it might be difficult to interpret what a vested interest is, but Mr. Robertson has explained and we will reinsert it into the definition.
Yes, and I do think that the issue raised by Honorable Jelle does make sense, especially for women, because that issue of vested interest, they might not be the owner, but they might have that vested interest, the wife and the children. I think it is important that it should be included. Any contrary view, members? None. Can we go to the next one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. If the document can be forwarded to page 11, where we deal with a domestic relationship. Currently, in terms of SAYA,
can we give SAYA a minute to sort out his documents, because he's a little bit slow. And can we come back after a minute, members? Comfort break.
Okay.
Bonani was sharing.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
So you have donated powers to...
Yes,
can you repeat my powers?
Are you okay now, Mr. Mfunje?
Chair, Bonani is in charge, so it's not me today. My apologies.
Oh, okay. Mr. Ramano, please don't be slow. We can hear you. Okay. Mr. Roberts, can you proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The definition of domestic relationship, amongst others, include in paragraph F, the instance where a complainant and a respondent share or shared the same residence. Amendments were proposed to include premises or property within the preceding year in paragraph F of the definition. The first option, writs paragraph F of the reference to the preceding year. Some of the commentators raised the objection against this due to the fact that what if persons share a domestic relationship just before a year has passed and domestic violence takes place. The first option do provide for this. On the other hand, according to our submission, is the premises and property requirement extends this definition, or rather makes this definition quite wide. And a premises may, amongst others, include something like a place where you work, and property may even include something like a bicycle. My submission is that premises and property should probably be excluded from this definition. And again, to further facilitate the interpretation of the Act, a new definition of residence is, amongst others, proposed. And the definition of residence, according to the new definition, is any part of any structure, including a building, house, room, shed, hut, tent, mobile home, caravan, boat, or other place that is used as a place of residence by a natural person, irrespective whether or not other people also occupy that structure. I again raise my concerns here. If you look at the Criminal and Related Matters Amendment Act, that this paragraph F can has various unintended consequences. The mere fact that people live together, as I already indicated, there's no family or domestic nexus. And to make the bail provisions and the minimum sentences applicable, to such a person can have unintended consequences. However, if you look at other countries' domestic violence legislation, they do recognize that the sharing of property by persons do amount to a domestic relationship, but they do qualify it in terms of their legislation, mainly either a family relationship or a domestic relationship must exist. Option that is proposed is to insert the underlined phrase, namely that the persons must be in close relationship and that they must share the residence. The new proposal do away with the recency requirement, as well as premises of property, as well as the preceding year. I'll stop here for comment. Members?
Are we happy with the exclusion of recently and other issues that were included earlier on and stick to what has been proposed now? That the person in a close relationship that they must share the residence, the same residence. Is there any objection to that? I don't see any. You can proceed, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. If Bonani can just go down.
But Mr. Roberts, because you were the one who was also doing the criminal and related matters, where you think that there is a possibility that that law might need to be revisited before it is passed, please keep a watching brief on that bill, because it is not yet before the National Assembly. We have just passed it in the committee. Just keep a watching brief on the discussions and the impact that they might have on the Criminal Law and Related Matters Amendment Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. I will, but my submission is that some of the issues were adverse consequences that emanate in relation to the Domestic Violence Act can be addressed in the Domestic Violence Act itself. Amongst others, the big thing is to define what is offence against a person in a domestic relationship. That is probably something that can be addressed in this bill. And most of the amendments that will facilitate a more effective implementation of the Criminal Related Matters Amendment Bill should be affected in the Domestic Violence Act. But I will keep tabs on whatever happens. If Mr. Romano can just move down to page 13, stop there. There's a new proposal, and that relates to the insertion of sexual harassment in the definition of domestic violence. Currently, harassment, or rather the conduct that is defined as harassment, also includes sexual harassment. My submission is various countries do deal separately with sexual harassment in the definitions of conduct that amounts to domestic violence. My submission, it can be excluded from the current provision that deals with harassment and can be inserted as a separate conduct that amounts to domestic violence. A further proposal or provision that is inserted in the definition of domestic violence is that of related person abuse. I will discuss it when we get to the definition of related abuse. The related person abuse is to cater for instances where a related person, I can almost say, is harassed or certain conduct is directed towards him, and that conduct also harasses or hurts the complainant. I will discuss it when we do get to the definition. If we can go down to paragraph I, related person is removed from paragraph I due to the fact that according to me it makes it so wide that there may be some problematic aspects that emanate from that. In any case, related person is dealt with in related person abuse. If you can go down, please, Mr. Romano, to there. Paragraph J of the definition of domestic violence is a catch-all provision. It overlaps with various other definitions. And a new definition is proposed here to narrow its ambit and to give, it's called the objective standard to evaluate conduct that falls within the catch-all provision. According to the proposed amendment, it's still a little, it is defined as any behavior towards the complainant, and then is qualified by a reasonable person test who must consider the behavior in question as intimidating, threatening, abusive, degrading, offensive, or humiliating, or inspire the reasonable belief that harm may be caused to the complainant. And again, a related person is omitted from this definition. One must remember that almost all conduct that amounts to domestic violence is already dealt with in paragraphs A to I. But there may be certain instances which fall outside the current conduct in that paragraph. And this is just to ensure that if there is any other kind of conduct that is not provided for in paragraphs A to I, that the court may, through a reasonable person test, still regard certain conduct as domestic violence, as is further defined in the new proposed paragraph J. Is there any comment on this paragraph, please?
I don't see any. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Next definition is economic abuse. We do remove related person from the definition. And that is to cater for the concerns made of the South African police, which also regarded that economic abuse or any other conduct which referred to related abuse or related person abuse may be too wide. If we can go down, there's also other definition of economic abuse that is proposed. To a large extent, the current definition is retained in paragraph A. If you can go to page 16, please. But there are certain amendments proposed to the current definition. Firstly, the disposal of household effects or other property of the complainant is qualified with the insertion of the following words, without the complainant's permission. And two new types of conduct is inserted, amongst others, the use of financial resources of the complainant without the complainant's permission, or the quiescing of a complainant to sign a legal document that would enable the complainant's finances to be managed by another person. That is the new conduct that's included, that in paragraph C and D, and the others is mainly amendments to the current definition as is in the bill. Is there any comments on this definition?
No. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Mr. Romano, can you go to page 17, please?
I'm really, really sorry. Yes, I'm really, really sorry to take us back. I lost us a bit. Elder abuse. Okay, no, I'm covered. Thank you. I just needed to know what an older person is. So it's defined in the Older Persons Act. I'm good now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Yoko.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. On page 17, again, as a result of proposed amendments to the harassment conduct, the definition of electronic communication is somewhat amended, mainly to include without limitation voice, sound, data, text, video, etc., that is transmitted by means of an electronic communication service. That is to cater for the proposed new definition of harassment. If Mr. Romano can go to page 19. Page 19, 20, especially 20. There's certain amendments that is proposed to emotional, verbal, or psychological abuse. The words threatening, offensive, intimidating is amongst others inserted in the heading, and it's qualified that causes emotional or psychological harm to a complainant. And then in the following paragraphs, what constitute emotional or psychological abuse, related person is removed from the various paragraphs. If Mr. Romano can go down to paragraph E of the definition. The definition or the paragraph E was already explained to the committee, and that relates to the destruction of property in close vicinity of a complainant that may cause emotional or psychological harm. And also the harm to animals is included. Two new paragraphs is however inserted in the definition of this conduct that amounts to domestic violence, namely to disclose or threatening to disclose the complainant's sexual orientation to others against the complainant's wishes, or to threaten the complainant with death or injury of any other person. And the last one is to threaten to commit suicide or self-harm. Especially the last one is something that's frequently used in a domestic relationship. The complainant is actually threatened by another who threatens to commit suicide or self-harm. Is there any comments on this amendment?
Why are you limiting it to disclose or threaten to disclose a complainant's sexual orientation to others against the complainant's wishes. It might go further than that. Sometimes a person might want to threaten to disclose anything that is detrimental to image other than the issue of your sexual orientation. Let's take for an example the recent event in Zimbabwe where the vice president was, according to him, was threatened with a disclosure of his sexual relationships.
May I also add to what you've just said?
Yes, Honorable Yago.
I also wanted to say basically what you are saying. However, I also wanted to add that there's more to just threatening to disclose someone's sexual orientation. There's also sometimes people would use what we call revenge porn, where they would then threaten to post your nude or your whatever compromising positions that they've taken visuals of. So don't you think perhaps we should also add that into this definition?
Yes.
Honorable Wilma?
Honorable Wotrochen?
Thank you, Chair. I agree with what Honorable Yaku said. I'm not sure if I see it, but sorry if I'm a little bit slow. Just to go back to electronic communication, you added, for example, voice, sound, text or data, text, etc. is added, but I don't see the word social media, or is anything under social media covered in that paragraph? I'm not sure. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Robertson?
Regarding the definition of electronic communication, I think everything else is included. The text, data, video is mainly the content of a data message. And the definition explains that it is anything that is actually distributed by electronic means, by electronic service. So it includes basically everything that you can think of that can be distributed via electronic communications. Regarding the additional grounds, or let's call it aspects that may be included, one must also, it is correct, this kind of conduct to a large extent also overlaps with harassment. One can include here to include anything private that's distributed to another, which will include, amongst others, private information, personal sexual relationships, etc. But one must also take cognizance of the fact that the definition is an open-ended definition by virtue of the word including that is used before the starting of the various paragraphs. So it can be anything else. And the conduct in paragraphs A and further on merely clarifies what can be considered as emotional, verbal, or psychological abuse. By all means, we can include other conduct in it. It's not a problem, but one must also take cognizance of the fact that it is already an open-ended definition. So if there's further proposals of what must be inserted there, it will be included. Also, one must look at the other conduct, like I said, harassment, as well as sexual harassment. which do deal with some of the issues that is already raised here. But like I said, if I did note that sexual relationships is included, if there's anything else that must be included, please make proposals to that effect, and it will be included. If we can go on, the next definition relates to harassment. And that is on harassment. I do make certain comments regarding the first, the current definition of harassment. I'm not going to deal with each and every aspect thereof. My concern is that the current definition relates to conduct that the respondent knows or ought to know. This kind of requires that the respondent must foresee the probability that it may cause harm. In South African criminal law, if we look at common assault, the test is usually what the victim subjectively foresee, namely that harm may be caused. And my submission is that we probably need to move away from the requirement that the respondent knows or ought to know, and merely states that it is conduct which the complainant perceives as conduct that may cause harm. The related person aspects is removed from the definition to a large extent, and that is mainly to deal with the previous concerns about the related person. But as I will indicate in the new proposed definition, we must probably, in respect of harassment, detain a related person due to the fact that harassment is kind of conduct that is usually directed at a person in close relationship with the complainant, and that is to cause harm to the complainant. If you can move down, Mr. Romano. Mr. Romano, can you move to the next page, please? Okay, a new proposed amendment of harassment basically retains the first paragraph of the current definition of harassment, namely watching, bruising or accosting a complainant or a related person, or loitering near or outside the place where the complainant or related person works, but it's then qualified, which inspires the belief in a complainant that he or she or related person may be harmed or their property may be damaged. Can you move down, please? New conduct that is included in the definition is, amongst others, to enter any part of joint residence that is exclusively used by the complainant or other property of the complainant without the complainant's permission. In various legislation of other countries, this conduct is specifically recognized. It's usually where a complainant has a study which she usually locks, and then when she's not there, the respondent will gain access to that private space of the complainant. A new other conduct that is inserted is to interfere with any property that is exclusively used by or in the complainant's possession. It's mainly to interfere with somebody's motor car. Can disable the braking function, or to interfere with somebody's computer. You can install malware on it, or you can install programs on it to, amongst others, monitor or intercept communications from the complainant. Paragraph D makes provision for the continuous and repeated calling of a complainant, irrespective of whether any message is actually conveyed to a complainant. This is very harassing. Like, you can actually call somebody via cell phone about 100 times a day, and if the complainant sees the respondents, he will not answer, but it causes harm and it is of a harassing nature. Something that happened overseas is where somebody actually sends 1,000 spam emails to somebody, flooding their storage capacity on a computer. So this is conduct that needs to be addressed. I do delete the current paragraph B then. If we can go down to paragraph C, can we see the full paragraph, Mr. Romano? Paragraph C, currently relates to where you send somebody to the complainant. It may be something like videos, photos or texts, or objects, or also leaving them where it can be found or given or brought to a complainant. However, some aspects that is not addressed in the preceding paragraphs, amongst others, relates to the disclosure through electronic communications. Mr. Romano, can you move down to the end of the page, please? Is to disclose certain messages through electronic communications that is abusive, degrading, offensive, or humiliating, or violates the sexual integrity of a complainant, or even inspires a belief that in a complainant that she or other person may be harmed. What this clause also does is to make sure that the disclosure of electronic communications is not the only thing on which the provision concentrates. It also provides for the real lifetime, or let me rather say, the distribution of the same kind of communications without, let's call it in the real world, without the intervention of cyberspace. So if a person distributes abusive letters or video to a complainant, it will be covered in terms of this. The second clause, although it's also marked as paragraph F, it should be paragraph G, relates mainly to instances where a respondent discloses this harmful communications in cyberspace to another person or in the real world. Hence, similar communications to another person. And that is why the definition of communication is inserted, to provide for the real world distribution of malicious material, and why the definition of electronic communications is amended to provide for basically the same in cyberspace. Previously, the concerns were raised, amongst others, about the sexual, let's call it material regarding where a person may have a sexual relationship regarding somebody else. I, to a large extent, believe that it may be covered under paragraphs S or G, especially the second F, which is paragraph G, where certain private information is distributed to another person. It will definitely cover a sexual relationship with another person. Regarding the concern that was raised regarding revenge pornography, the Cyber Crimes Bill or Act do provide for specific offences regarding intimate images and revenge pornography. I believe under paragraph F and the second F, the conduct that violates or offends the sexual integrity of a complainant or private information do cover for such instances. And I don't think it's really necessary to insert it specifically under domestic violence. I'll stop here for comments. Any comments?
There seems to be none. Can I suggest that we have a 10-minute break until 11:15? A tea break. Maybe members will come back refreshed.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes, thank you.
Supported,
Honorable Yako?
I was saying I support that.
Okay.
I was already having tea,
okay. So, yes, yeah, it's 6 minutes past. Can you come back at 11:16? Members. At the rate at which we are going, can I suggest that if we don't finish today, we meet tomorrow, we make an application to the House Chair to meet tomorrow during sitting from 2 to 5 to conclude this area of work so that we can next week start dealing with a cleaned document where we can be able to make some firm decisions as to the direction that this bill must take. Can we just spend 5 minutes or less on that issue, members? Is that acceptable?
Acceptable.
Thank you. Is there any contrary view? None. So we'll ask the committee secretary to make the committee secretariat to make an application to the chair for us to meet during plenary. I know that we'll be having these small plenaries tomorrow. That we met during that time to further process this bill. Thank you very much. Can we proceed, Mr. Robertson?
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. I did ask for comments on the new proposed provision that deals with harassment. I must also indicate that sexual harassment is omitted from the current definition of harassment.
But is it part of the bill?
Sexual harassment is part of the bill. It is inserted as a separate, it's separate conduct that amounts to harassment.
Okay.
Members, any comment on this one? No comment. Can we proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Mr. Romano, can you go to the next page, please? The definition of harm in the that it's a new definition that's inserted in the Domestic Violence Act. Previously, there was no definition of harm, and harm is defined as mental, psychological, physical, or economical harm. It is similar to harm as in the Protection from Harassment Act. It do include almost each and every instance of harm that exists. But my submission is it may be problematic in certain areas of the bill. Amongst others, let's take Section 84B of the Domestic Violence Act. A peace officer may arrest a person if there is a contravention of a protection order, if the complainant provides an affidavit to the peace officer, amongst others stating that there is a contravention of the protection order, and the peace officer may arrest the respondent if there is harm. Psychological and mental harm, it's probably difficult for a peace officer to determine. So previously the DVA functioned without this definition. It's my submission it's probably not necessary to include this definition. In any case, in each and every definition of what amounts to domestic violence, we refer to harm, it will include mental, psychological, physical, or economical harm. Obviously, if there's physical harm, which is an instance of domestic violence, it's not necessary that a person will suffer domestic harm. And also, there is a specific conduct that relates to emotional, verbal, and psychological harm. This is also not included or in line with the proposed definition of harm, since emotional mental or psychological harm to a large extent, and that type of conduct or should be redefined then with reference to the definition of harm. I don't know, it's my submission is probably not necessary to include a definition of harm. But it's up to the committee to decide. Ms. Clark can probably give a substantial input on this if she's available. Ms. Clark?
Yeah, but I think when we deal with harm, there is generally a tendency minimizing the impact of psychological and emotional abuse, of which I do think that most people in domestic violence are victims of that even more than the physical abuse. And the destructive nature in the psychological makeup of that person is much more severe, sometimes even more than the physical abuse. I don't think that it's something that we should just browse over it. I think we have to apply ourselves much more deeper into it, Mr. Roberts. I think most women are victims of psychological abuse, which is, I do agree with you, it's not easy to prove sometimes, but I think in the course of giving evidence in court, I do think that the court can be in a position to, based on the evidence led, can be in a position to determine whether psychological abuse or emotional abuse did happen. But I don't think that it would be right that we just gloss over it. I think it's very, very serious.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. If I Mr. Mario, can you?
Honorable Yako.
Mufuke.
Oh, sorry, Honorable Mufuke. Your voice is a little bit similar today.
Thank you very much. Chair, I just want to check. I'm still concerned about what was raised about the peace officers and the fact that Mr. Robertson has just raised it. I've been asking myself a question. What is a peace officer? Because in South Africa, we have three committees. We have community safety. We have neighborhood. And at some stage, they clash. We don't know who calls himself or herself a peace officer. And that, in most cases, it becomes also a problem in communities that others are not trusted. Can we get a clarity on that?
Honorable Mfuke, I think your previous role as the chair of the Portfolio Committee on Safety is coming into play today, Mr. Roberts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Peace officer is a person that is appointed as a peace officer in terms of section, if I remember correctly, 334 of the Criminal Procedure Act, 335, where it states that a minister may appoint certain persons as peace officers in respect of certain offences, but also in respect of certain conduct. And I think a peace officer is also defined in Section 1 of the Criminal Procedure Act. I haven't got the Act before me, but to include, amongst others, a police official as well as a peace officer appointed in terms of Section 335. So peace officer in the context of the DVA must be interpreted with reference to Section 1 of the CPA, as well as those persons that is specifically appointed by the Minister of Justice as peace officers in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act.
Now, Chairperson, follow up.
Yes, Honorable Mfuke.
Can Mr. Robertson tell me that how many do we have? And do you know that anyone who has been appointed by the minister? Because I'm scared that we come up with things that at the end, we won't find these people on the ground. Because if there should be peace officers and appointed, they should be trained. Where is that part fully? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Tritis. And one of my tasks in the department is also to appoint peace officers. In terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, or at least to oversee that. The persons that has been appointed as peace officers is usually published in the Government Gazette. If I remember correctly, and about 5 years ago, there were a kind of rationalization of all the various notices that were published. The categories of persons is specifically defined. In terms of the notice, what is usually specified is that a peace officer must have certain requirements, and it's usually the Minister of Police that specify or determine what requirements must be adhered to before a person can be appointed as a peace officer, which amongst others include training in relation to the functions that they must fulfill. Most of the persons that were to date appointed mainly relate to certain offences in terms of certain legislation, and in respect of which they exercise mainly the same powers as that of the South African Police Service. I will provide a list of all the peace officers that were to date appointed, as well as the criteria or requirements that they must adhere to, before they can be appointed as a peace officer. It's quite stringent, and I believe it's almost on par with that of the South African Police Service.
The issue is that, as of now, do you think we have enough to implement this bill? Do we have enough of them to implement this bill once passed by Parliament?
Mr. Chairperson, we must distinguish between the South African Police Service and also peace officers, although the South African Police Service is also peace officers. My submission is that we have enough peace officers to implement the bill. Section 3 of the bill, in any event, extends the bill, amongst others, to peace officers who are not members of the South African Police Service, but also include them. So this is quite innovative in terms of the bill, since certain powers of peace officers that is not police is recognized to assist with the implementation of the bill. I did yesterday also circulate a new innovative provision regarding domestic violence safety monitoring orders. I did provide that, amongst others, the South African Police Service and peace officers have a role to play there. My submission is, yes, we've got enough people. Why we extend the bill to also peace officers is mainly due to the fact that in various rural areas, police may not always be readily available, but there may be peace officers that is even part of the community or live there. They can really assist in the implementation of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Nivo Tachan.
Thank you very much, Chair. I would like to add to the question that was just asked regarding the victims, when the victims of domestic violence contact SAPS, and then for example, I call SAPS for domestic violence reasons, and then a peace officer comes, who would send the peace officer? Because if I've contacted SAPS, I would expect a SAPS official to come. And then second question regarding the peace officer, who monitors or supervises them? Because as Mr. Robertson indicates, the minister appoints them. However, who monitors or supervises them? And then, yes, you said it is difficult to identify psychological or mental abuse in the moment. Physical abuse is slightly easier because there are bruises to show. But is there any best practice in terms of training that SAPS can be provided with, that when they arrive on the scene, they can identify, the non-visible kinds of abuse like mental or psychological abuse? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Justin.
Can I make a follow-up on this?
Honorable Jalia.
Yes, on the that same question of Honorable Velmo, I just want to find out when the complainant report to the police station. Are they going to send the peace officers? Because I thought that the peace officers are in the community. They are working in the community, not as police. Even if they are doing the work of the police, assisting the police. But if I report my matter at the police station, are they going to send the peace officers? It's a question, are they deploying them in order to come and deal with those issues. I just wanted to find out if there's anything like that.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Mpuke.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I can confirm that I'm not convinced with that answer. And my question was saying, with the challenges that we are having of many organizations that, as I mentioned, CPF, street committees, this and this, where do they come from? Because where I'm sitting, I don't know them. I haven't seen them. And I'm sure they were supposed to be people that are elected amongst communities and to be known. When you have to report a matter and the police officers tell you that you go to so-and-so, how are you going to know that you have appointed the right peace officer in your area? Let us get this thing right. As you said that I've been in this space, I'm not convinced and I'll never be convinced until I'm shown that. I don't think it's right. And if they're appointed, how are the criteria and also the requirements? Because sometimes people that are appointed, that are making life easy for women, is the very same people in their communities. So that one, I want us to deal with it and understand it maybe later. But at the moment, the word peace officer for me, where there's no peace with women, it's difficult. Thank you.
Yes, thanks, Chair. I wish first to share how the Criminal Procedure Act defines a peace officer. It says so that Chair, we see if the question by Honorable Mofokeng is covered by this definition, so that we're able to move. A peace officer includes any magistrate, justice, police official, correctional official as defined in section of the Correctional Services Act, and in relation to any area, offense, class of offense or power referred to in a notice issued under section 34, subsection 1. Any person who is a peace officer under that section. So, Chair, the definition in the Criminal Procedure Act as it stands now does not cover the factors that which Honorable Fogan was mentioning of your community policing forum and all that and all that and all that. And remember, if you take the discussion up back on the duty to report, anyone who experiences or who is able to see domestic violence happening has a duty to report. But the truth is, what Honorable Mofokeng is saying is correlated to what you were asking, Chair, that do we actually have enough of them to perform this duty? Now, the truth is, Chair, these people who are mentioned in the Criminal Procedure Act as peace officers are not always accessible to our communities. And the purpose of the Act is ensure that we curb and deal decisively with gender-based violence, which in its nature, it happens in households. Now, would there be an illegality now if we do add from what is defined from the Criminal Procedure Act, what Honorable Mofokeng is saying in terms of defining who then becomes the peace officer? Thank you very much. I wanted to share that.
Thank you. And if we add, then the other question raised by Honorable Mofokeng is that of training. Others might not need training, the magistrates and others that are defined in the Criminal Procedure Act. But when you add other people, then that issue of training would be relevant. Mr. Robertson?
Mr. Chairperson, first the question. If I phone the police you expect the police to come, that's correct. Obviously, the police cannot send out a peace officer. They're regulated by different structures. I can take an example, for instance, municipal police is a peace officer. That is prescribed in terms of Section 334 of the Criminal Procedure Act. People that serve the Liquor Act, or rather execute certain functions in terms of the Liquor Act in the various provinces as peace officers. So if you contact the police must come. End of story. They cannot send a peace officer. But in terms of Section 3 of the Domestic Violence Act, obviously if there's an incident of domestic violence, all peace officers, including a magistrate right through to Section 334 appointed peace officer, may arrest the respondent if there's certain offences committed, as you set out in that section. It is correct. Peace officers is limited to certain categories of people. They must have specific prescribed training. I will send a notice through that do send it out. Other people like street committees, etc., is not peace officers for purposes of the Act. One must also take into account delictual liability usually always follow where there's coercive powers. If a peace officer acts outside his, let's call it, recognized legitimate powers or functions, his employer is delictual liability for each and every conduct. It's similar to police. So you cannot appoint each and every person as a peace officer, but currently it's restricted to persons that serve a certain structure in terms of law. Thank you.
I think we might need to flip. This issue and come back to it, because the issue is how to ensure the three bills that we are going to pass compared to what we have currently. Because the expectation out there is not about just tinkering with the system, is to ensure that once these bills are passed, there is going to be enough capacity to ensure that our people see justice being done in the area of gender-based violence. Now, given that scenario, how do we ensure that we have enough trained people who would ensure that they don't act outside of their powers, where issues of delictual liability can arise, but at the same time we have enough human capacity coordinated properly to ensure that these issues are addressed. It might not be an issue of legal drafting, it might not, but it might also be an issue of continuous oversight by both ourselves and the Portfolio Committee on Police to ensure proper oversight. But I think it is important that we give a proper enabler in the legislation to ensure that this capacity is well coordinated to assist our people in the implementation of these three GBV bills. So can we flag it and come back to it to deal with all these concerns and to ensure that it is properly captured in the drafting, and also to identify issues that are of continuous oversight?
Yes, Mr. Chairperson.
And I think there is an issue here by Honorable Nebutakhans that even for members of the committee, we need to have more information on this issue of peace officers. Can we proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. If we can go to the definition of intimidation, especially the new proposed clause. Let's go a bit back. Thank you, Stop. I do indicate that intimidation can take place through other conduct other than uttering and conveying. That is currently in the definition in the bill. It should be expanded, and a new definition of intimidation is therefore proposed. Amongst others, that defines intimidation as uttering or conveying threat, cause a complainant to receive a threat, or any conduct nearby or directed at a complainant which has the effect that a complainant fears for his or her safety or the damage of his or her property. Can be drafted in another way, but this is the first proposal. Any comment on this new definition?
No comment. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The next definition is that of physical abuse. Physical abuse, it's on page 25. Okay. According to me, there's the reference to complainant who is a children include abuse as defined in section 1 of the Children's Act in respect of a child. It's actually unnecessary and overextends the definition. In section 1 of the Children's Act, abuse is amongst others defined as assault, sexually abusing a child, bullying by other child, unlawful labor practices, exposing a child to certain violent behavior. So my submission that all the conduct that is in Section 1 of the Child Justice Act is in any event included in the current definitions of the various conduct that amounts to domestic violence. And it's my submission that the reference or the word starting from or in the case of till the end of the Child Justice Act can be omitted from the bill due to the fact that the conduct is already catered for under domestic violence. Is there any comment on this?
Welcome back, Honorable Sust. We know that you're in a secret forum.
Thank you, Chair. Interestingly enough, the Human Rights Commission is meeting with the Chief Whips at the moment, which is quite interesting. But I just wanted to comment on this issue, and that is, I presume that that would include a parent that is exercising parental guidance to a child, the common law process of parental, a moderate, reasonable parental chastisement in terms of the common law. How would that fit into the issue of, would that fall into the definition of physical abuse or not? Smacking a child, in other words.
Thank you very much, Honorable Swart. Mr. Robertson?
Mr. Swart, in terms of the definition of physical abuse, means any act or threatening act of physical violence. the mere smacking of a child is obviously either threatened or where it is executed amounts to physical violence and will be covered in terms of the conduct that is currently proposed as physical abuse. One can even go as far and say that even a perceived threat of physical abuse will be included here. So yes, it will be included.
Mr. Roberts, is there any case law on that? Because I do think that if there is case law, maybe by the Concord, obviously we would be bound by that. But I do think that maybe we are overstretching it a bit. I would say unreasonable abuse of a child would be not acceptable. But the way you are answering it, I think it might even be very, very difficult to raise a child properly.
I understand, and that is my concern, is the broadness. I agree with Mr. Roberts, it does cover that. The challenge is clearly where it goes beyond reasonableness, then it amounts to assault in terms of the common law. There's no constitutional court ruling, although I think there was a high court ruling, which should be only limited probably to the area where that decision was given. But I just want to avoid unintended consequences of a, where it is anything, where even I'm not fully supportive of a parent that goes beyond any form of reasonable chastisement should face charges of assault. That is established law in terms of assault laws, criminal law. But where it goes to threatened, so you say to your child, if you don't behave yourself, I'm going to give you a smack. In other words, that amounts to physical abuse in terms of this definition. We just need to avoid unintended consequences. And I know it's very difficult. Where do you draw that line? Because we do know there are many parents or guardians, step-parents, where there could be abuse taking place. So I just need to urge caution in this approach. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Swart. Honorable Swart. Any other views on this matter? Mr. Robertson?
Mr. Chairperson, I believe the Constitutional Court did abolish, amongst others, let's call it chastisement or eating of another person. As far as I can remember, Mr. Swartz referred to a High Court case, but I believe there was a Constitutional Court case regarding reasonable chastisement. I did read a case, and that is to the effect that, amongst others, any physical abuse is unconstitutional. And if you look at the argument of the court in that case, even threatened physical violence is something that must be regarded as unconstitutional. So I can't remember whether that did go to the Constitutional Court. It was Christian something that actually brought the application. I'll get a case, but yes, I think physical violence per se is restricted by our constitutional bounds, and even the threat of physical violence is restricted similarly. I will obtain the cases and give a summary of the cases to the committee. One may also then ask, coercive behavior is something similar. Every parent uses coercive behavior to keep the child on the right path. Even controlling behavior is something similar. And if there's a need to limit physical abuse, contrary and coercive behavior also need to be limited. My suspicion is probably not necessary, but if we argue in favor of the specific exclusion regarding children and for a parent, it may become problematic. Thank you.
Like Honorable Swart, I'm concerned about the unintended consequences. Can we flag that, and Mr. Roberts, can you also look at the case law on all of those issues? Because,
thank you, sir.
I mean, if you, the controlling behavior, threats, and then how does a parent discipline the child at all?
Chief, I stand corrected by Mr. Robertson. I do seem to remember there was a constitutional court ruling in this regard that we might not necessarily agree with it, but that might be the existing law. But I do share concerns about the broad definition when it's taken in the context of the whole domestic violence when it comes to the parent. That's something we need to bear in mind. But I'll be, I look forward to that case, but I think Mr. Roberts is correct. He does record there is a constitutional court ruling in this regard.
Is it a ruling or an obita in the court?
No, I think it was a specific judgment.
Ruling.
Yeah, a judgment that related specifically following, I think, the High Court decision that came up to the Constitutional Court. It was a judgment particularly on this very, and it was quite a controversial judgment, but I do believe it did uphold, if I remember correctly, uphold the High Court's decision that ruled the common law rule of moderate chastisement unconstitutional, if I remember correctly. But I'm sure it'll be good to look at that and then possibly to see if there's any way of limiting the definition here.
Okay, no, that's thank you, Honorable Swart. I think we will look at that because also we wouldn't want to pass something that is going to be unconstitutional or challengeable successful in the Constitutional Court. We'll come back to that. Mr. Roberts, if we can circulate that case so that members can read it, and we can see, as Honorable Swart has said, whether is there any space to maneuver. If not, then it would be important that we run as a state massive education around it. Because if there is no massive education around it, you might run a risk of criminalizing the whole society. Can
you do that? Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I will do that. If Mr. Romano can move to the next page, please. On the next page, thank you. But down, stop like that. Previously, concerns were raised amongst the police about the related person issue. In the text that's indicated as discussion, February 2011, the related person definition, as was inserted by the bill, is retained. Previously, in the other definition, to restrict its ambit, it was proposed that or any other person place a relationship with the complainant be excised from that definition. But if the related abuse, related person abuse clause is accepted by the committee, then we can keep it as is. On at the bottom of page 26, new conduct that relates to domestic violence, is inserted to the definition of related person abuse. And that means where the complainant is threatened with the causing of physical violence to or damage the property of a related person, where the related person is threatened with violence or causing damage to property, or where act of violence or damage to property of the related person is committed, and where such actions, can you move to the next page, please? And then the definitions further specify that where such actions can, in the circumstances, be regarded as abuse to cause harm to the complainant. So if we retain related person abuse in this form, it is qualified that this abuse must cause harm to the complainant. This will have the effect that a complainant can, in this circumstances, apply for a domestic violence protection order, but she can do it only on her own right and for to protect her against such abuse. One must remember that in terms of protection order, a court may, amongst others, also restrict or rather prohibit the respondent to damage any other person's property or harm another person who is not necessarily a complainant. So this is one option to address the related person issue through new conduct that amounts to domestic violence. Is there any views on this? Okay, no views. I'll continue then.
Proceed.
Thank you. I already discussed the residence, the new definition of residence that is inserted. I'm going to deal with it again. If Mr. Romano can go down to the definition of sexual abuse, it's on page 27. Again, in this definition...
Sorry, Mr. Roberts, just before you proceed. Mr. Romano, what time are we starting today? Because it's Wednesday. We're starting at 2 or 3. Maybe Mr. Swart can also assist.
I think it's 3 p.m., Chair.
3 p.m.
Yes, I think it's 3
p.m.
Your question time is at 3 p.m.
Yes, Chair. It's 3 o'clock, Chair.
3 o'clock. So, members, we will push until what time? It's 2:30.
Chair, I might have to apologize and leave, but I do understand the urgency of this. Well, I need to travel as well to get to the city. But
when
you go, thank you, Chair.
Okay, maybe yes. Maybe I must reframe my question differently. How many members would need to live and be present physically in the house?
I need to leave and be physically present, Chair, so I would need to leave, but I do understand the need to continue with the legislation.
Chair, yes. Thank you. I'm already in Parliament. I won't have to travel. I'm fine. Thank you.
Other members? Then we are fine. So, Honorable Swart, we are still in a process of cleaning the document. We will still have to come back to this document from clause one again, so you wouldn't miss that much. Can we proceed until 2:30? Members, is that fine? Or members can just take their lunch and as we are proceeding, and have a working lunch, so that we don't miss anything and we use our time much more efficiently. Can you push until 2:30?
Okay, Chair. Fine.
Chair, Honourable Nihot Drukhan has her hand up.
Honourable Dr. Nihot Drukhan.
Thank you very much, Chair. I would like to propose 2:00 because the interpreters are tired and will have to continue in plenary. So I might have to leave at 2:00 because the interpreters will need to have a break before plenary. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, can we adjourn at 2:00?
Yes, I withdraw, Chair, 2:30. 2:00 is fine. I
join. Okay. Thank you very much. I think Honorable Nihot Drukhan has a valid point. We have to take care of the interpreters. So we will adjourn at 2:00. You can proceed, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The next definition is that of sexual abuse. Again, it refers at the bottom of the definition. In the case of the complainant is a child, constitutes sexual abuse as contemplated in the Children's Act 2005. In the Children's Act, sexual molesting or assaulting a child, or allowing that to happen. And various other conduct is specifically defined as what constitutes sexual abuse of a child. My submission is that all the conduct in paragraphs A, B, C, and D is already sexual offenses in terms of the Criminal Law and Sexual Offenses Act, which is by implication part of the definition. And it's my submission that the words or in the case of complainant till the end of the Children's Act 2005 can be omitted from the bill. The only problem is that the Children's Act doesn't, well, it refers to sexual molesting, which is something odd. Molesting is something similar to assault. That is the only conduct, if it's not assault, that is not catered for in the Criminal Law Sexual Offences Act. My submission is we can omit the words as already specified. Thank you. Any comments?
Mr. Roberts, just do your work and I will do mine. I will invite comments. Just indicate that you are done so that we do not have too many chairpersons who are chairing. Members, do you have anything on this clause? And none. Can you proceed, Mr. Robertson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Mr. Romano, can you go down, bottom page 28, sexual harassment. Stop. Sexual harassment, as indicated, is excised from harassment, and it's retained as specific conduct that amounts to sexual harassment. Amendments indicated in the red is affected to the current definition. What we do is substitute the words person in a domestic relationship with that of a respondent, and we omit related person in the rest of the definition. And also, yeah, that's the main amendment that is affected to the clause. It's the first one, it must be retained I think Ms. Clark did raise a concern that paragraph B is something that relates to a work situation. Since it was asserted in the Protection of Harassment Act and was taken over in the Domestic Violence Act, my submission is that this behavior is harassing in nature and must be retained. And that's, I'm finished, Mr. Chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts. Any comments, members? None. You can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. The next amendment relates to the definition of spiritual abuse. It's mainly a drafting error that is corrected due to the fact that the including paragraph becomes paragraph D now. What is done here is that we insert in paragraph D that a conduct can be committed against a complainant or a related person. This was done mainly at the insistence of Ms. Clark. Obviously, I think a justification is to the effect that the use of religious text to justify certain abusive behavior, even if it relates to a related person, may to an extent also cause psychological and emotional harm to a complainant. If Ms. Clark wants to explain it further, she's welcome, I suppose. I'm finished.
Ms. Clark?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just in regard to the insertion in D, the reference, for example, could be used where religious text is used, spare the rod, spoil the child, using that to use the spiritual text to cause the complainant to do or comply with certain actions of the respondent. And that is why I thought that it would be important to include a related person here. I think each section, one should consider where it is appropriate to include related person or not. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. Your members?
Yes, Swatya.
Honorable Swat.
Chair, I have a significant problems with the issue related to spiritual abuse. I don't think we've properly considered the submission by FORSA, which represented more than 6 million South Africans. The very example that has just been given indicates how one needs to be very careful when it comes to the inclusion of this definition of spiritual abuse. Whilst I do appreciate that spiritual abuse might take place, but now when you're raising for a court then to look into text, the courts have previously not looked on doctrinal religious items in the past, and I've got a significant challenge with the definition. If you then look in the broader context of what does it mean, harm, emotional, verbal, or psychological, we need to find a way, if it must be inserted, which some members might believe, of limiting it. Given the fact that the FORSA submission indicates that this is firstly covered by your broader definitions of what is coercive behavior in this act. Secondly, it is covered in other acts, the Intimidation Act, the Protection from Intimidation and Harassment Act, the Promotion of Equality and Prevention Act, as well as constitutional court decisions. So I'm I want to put a big red flag as far as we're concerned with this clause, bearing in mind that, as other members have indicated when we previously discussed this, that, and some of the submitters did say that, yes, there is spiritual abuse that does take place. My question is whether it is covered already sufficiently in other definitions. And when you start referring to specific texts, religious or spiritual texts or beliefs, I think we're entering a very dangerous area. The Constitutional Court has itself indicated in the Fareed judgment that South Africa must be very cautious to insist that people of faith are forced to choose between their faith and the law. And I think that that very example, whilst I appreciate Ms. Clark, it's a great example, because people might say, I choose rather to apply my understanding of a biblical belief, and obviously we need to find a way of containing that without, in the context of domestic violence. I would ask a specific, and that's a very interesting question, because obviously one wants to, the law has now made it very clear that a parent, I don't agree with it, but a parent may not smack their child for disciplinary purposes. There are other disciplinary purposes. But I want to take it broader. What about an imam or a rabbi that speaks from the pulpit, or a Roman Catholic person that speaks and says, I'm opposed to abortion, for example? Is that then resulting in psychological, emotional harm to a person that has an abortion? Can that complainant then say, but this Roman Catholic pastor or has now committed an act of domestic violence against me because that has caused me psychological harm? So you understand unintended consequences. And so I would just urge great caution. And for us, it's a big red flag, this clause. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Other members? In the meantime, Honorable Swart, would you also consider an option maybe that would cover your concerns, if you can also give us how it should be phrased so that in case other members feel that it needs to be there, how do we create an option that can be considered when we are doing the consideration of the bill as a whole that would take into consideration the concerns you have raised? Would you work on it?
I will do that, Chair. But can I just ask a specific question? Mm-hmm. Whether this is not covered by the broader definitions already, yes, as a matter of law?
Yes.
That's the specific question I've got.
Yes.
When you've got control, you've got, in terms of the amended definitions now, if it was to be deleted, would it have any negative impact? And is it not covered in terms of, firstly, other laws, secondly, the general definitions in this Act? And that is what the force of submission is. It says that the concerns raised about spiritual abuse is already covered in the general definitions of this bill as well as in other acts. That's the specific question that Mr. Roberts is welcome to come back to us on that.
Thank you very much, Honorable Swart. Honorable Nipo Traha.
Thank you very much, Chair. I understand what Honorable Swart is raising. However, after the FORSA submission, the other presenters were strongly of the view that spiritual abuse definition has to stay. And they had very strong views. And yes, I agree. It could be covered by other laws, but it's very sad to say that in South Africa, many abuses are happening in religious settings. However, I would like to ask, getting something from the CRL, I think it was a CRL, they did do investigations about religious organizations. And I am not sure if there was any mention about abuse in those investigations. I am of the view that spiritual abuse should remain in the definitions, and perhaps Honorable Swart can come with a proposal for phrasing. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I think the first Honorable Mpupo.
Chairperson, I think I agree with the Honorable Velma. Maybe it can be on the definition, but as we discussed before at length, spiritual abuse will have to remain, please.
Thank you very much. I think the question raised by Honorable Swart, firstly, before we go to the definition, it was whether the current definitions do cover spiritual abuse or not. Mr. Robertson?
Before we go, I'm not sure if maybe my gadget is not working when it comes to, because my hand is up now and it doesn't show with you. Can I
proceed, Honorable Taylor?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I agree with our honorables, the previous honorables, Mufuking and Comrade Honorable Velma, that we have to keep this one, but also in terms of the definition, I think we have to, I'm not sure if maybe the definition that Honorable Salt is talking about, got it very clear. If maybe we can get that definition that he's talking about that is covered in the definition, but I think this issue of spiritual abuse, it has to stay, Chairperson. I think as we will come back again, maybe we would have also looked into some phrasing. And then I think I like also this one of requesting also the CRC, if maybe also they can have an input on this one before we can close it, so that it stays, but it stays in a manner that it satisfies even the concerns of Honorable Swart. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Roberts. The question asked
by Mr. Swart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Let's look at the current definition. Coercive behavior, one can probably say yes, it do amount to, it may amount to abusive behavior, to coerce a person to do something against his or her will, but it's not specifically indicated. Controlling behavior, I don't think it's actually included, due to the fact that it relates to isolating a person, exploiting his resources, depriving him from means to be independent, regulating his behavior, can probably argue that yes, but it's not specifically referred to in the definition. Damage of property does not accommodate that. The other definition of, other definitions that may be relevant, harassment does not accommodate this. Economic abuse does not accommodate this. Emotional, verbal and psychological abuse, to an extent, yes, but again, it is not specific behavior that relates to certain conduct that where religion is used as a basis for abuse. So it's not specifically included in emotional or verbal abuse. Sexual abuse, it's not included. Sexual harassment, not included. Again, intimidation, the current definition relates to threats causing a complainant to receive a threat. And in an amended form is any conduct directed at a complainant which makes the complainant fear for his safety or safety of his property. It's not included in that. Physical abuse is definitely, physical abuse doesn't form part of physical abuse. So my submission is that it is not catered for in the other definitions per se. Okay, regarding whether we should retain it, I would like to first look at other countries before I make a written submission on this and maybe propose some other additional text how we can address this at some stage, Mr. Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Both yourself and Honorable Swart would provide us various other options that we can look at. But we all agree, even by Honorable Swart's submission, that there is that problem. And to the extent that, there is a problem, this bill is trying to respond to an existing problem. I think the issue would be how do we, for the purposes of drafting, ensure that there is a proper definition that takes into account also the issues that Honorable Swart has raised, issues of unintended consequences. We will come back to it. If you can further work on that, Mr. Robertson. And I think also Honorable Swart would look at your proposed option, and then we'll come back to it.
Chair, before we step down from this one, I want I think what would make me. Or maybe to go with this one, with the spiritual abuse that it has to stay. I think it is when we look sorry for that. In two ways, the one that covers emotions. Emotional, spiritually. And then also we must look on the side where it's like a physical abuse. Like I want to make an example with the issue of, you know, children have no choice when it comes to the issue of religious, spiritually choices. They always follow what the parent says. It should go. For example, we go to this religious setting as parents we choose. We our children, obviously, because they are young, they will fall into that one. Only to find that in the long run, when the law looks into this setup, it is something that is very abusive when it comes to the rights of the children or even the right of the people who belongs in that religion. For example, there was a this place, I don't know, it's kind of a cult where they did not even allow children to go to school because they were saying the world or the earth is about to end. So they don't have to go to school. They don't have to do, they are waiting, sitting there waiting. So the children who are from those parents, they still don't know what is right, what is wrong when it comes to choosing in this part. So I'm saying
if we go and work on this one, we must look into this one in two parts. That kind of setting and also the speech, emotional part of it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Jolie.
No, Chair, I appreciate the point that has just been made. The very point, the very answer to that is the existing laws, and that is my concern, is they are sufficient existing laws, such as the example that was given. There are existing laws that it is a crime to keep a child out of school in terms of the Schools Act. There are different. So I think I just want us to make sure that what you are saying here is not already covered by existing laws, understanding that there is a degree of spiritual abuse that does take place, but that we don't canvass every possible issue. And so I appreciate the concerns that members are raising, but whether it is unintended consequences or is not covered by existing laws, I think the explanation given by Mr. Robertson is that that it is covered to a certain degree in terms of the definitions, but not in particularity, and that is why the members want it specifically included. I will need to look at this and come back to you. So I thank you for the engagement.
Thank you very much, Honorable Swart. We will come back to it. And I think we should also, Honorable Swart would also put a proposal on his side. And Mr. Roberts would work on possible other options, but we do agree that there is spiritual abuse and that situation would need to be addressed. But we would also go further to say whatever intervention we would make, it should ensure that it does not create other unintended consequences. And because the issue with legal drafting is that you don't also need to end with the identification of the problem. You must come up with a solution that addresses all other challenges and protects all other rights, and so that you don't create further problems by the solution you would have given in dealing with one problem. So we would still come back to this and look at all other possible texts that tried to deal with this particular matter. Can we move to the next one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. It's on page 34. Page 34, section 3 deals with the arrest by a peace officer without a warrant, and subsection 1 provides that the peace officer may arrest the person who commits an offence, or rather act of domestic violence that is an offence, or an offence in terms of section 17(1)(a) of the DVA Act, which is a contravention of the protection order. And this section gives a peace officer the power to arrest such a person. It's a discretionary power, firstly, and secondly, it is based on a reasonable suspicion that a person may have committed such an offence. Subsection 2 of Section 3, similar, it provides that the peace officer may, at the scene of domestic violence, arrest the person who they reasonably suspect of having committed an act of domestic violence involving an offence of violence. The South African Police Service raised various concerns, amongst others, what happens if one of the persons acted in self-defence. There's also issues raised about the fact that a person who committed an offence at the scene of domestic violence cannot be arrested when he's not on the scene of domestic violence. To address the first concern, I think it's the biggest one, and that relates to this discretion that's afforded, firstly in terms of subsection 1, to arrest the person, and the obligation that's imposed in terms of subsection 2, namely that the peace officer must arrest a person that commits an offence of violence. It is submitted that the proposed clause 2 in the red on that page, let's go down a bit. Vanani, can you go down? Stop. May address firstly the problem foreseen by the police where, for instance, one of the persons actually acted in self-defense. And that is to do away with the measure or the ground of reasonable suspect and substitute that with reasonable grounds to believe. It's a higher standard. I'm not going to go through the cases, but it's explained in footnote 3 where it states what considerations constitute a reasonable ground for belief that an offence was apparently committed. So this is a proposal that may address that issue. Regarding the second issue, what if a person commits an offence of domestic violence and is not on the scene of the incident of domestic violence? That has not yet been addressed and need to be flagged. I previously did say that it's a kind of safeguard, amongst others, to ensure that when the police come to a scene of domestic violence, where they don't have something like an affidavit that's, or where there's no criminal charge that have been laid against a person, that they cannot then go and actually arrest somebody that's a kilometer from the incident of domestic violence. That probably still needs to be addressed to an instance. I cannot find a solution to that, but it can be provided for in law. It wouldn't be a problem. But insofar as it relates to address the powers of the police to arrest, I think if both subsection 1 and 2 is amended and reasonable suspicion is substituted with reasonable grounds to believe, it can address that concern by the South African police. Just something else I want to point out, and that relates to the reference to a person in both subsection 1 and 2. A person here is not necessarily the respondent. There's two options available. We can substitute the person with respondent. That will mean the person who is in a domestic relationship with the complainant. That will also further restrict the ambit of the clause to a certain category of persons. But I must point out, in various instances of domestic violence, third persons may be used to commit an offence that may constitute domestic violence. And if we do restrict the person, or change the person in subsection 1 and 2 to a respondent, the police cannot arrest the third person that is used to commit acts of domestic violence that constitute an offence. In the footnote 3, I do refer to the various case law that do set out what is a reasonable ground to believe. I'm not going to deal with that. You can, the committee members can read the footnote. I must also point out, depending on our decision here, in the schedule to the bill, Section 41K of the Criminal Procedure Act is amended. And whatever decision is taken in respect of this clause, similar amendments should be affected to the Criminal Procedure Act in the schedule to the bill. Thank you. Finish.
Thank you. Any views on this one, members? Honourable Hugo Tachin, is that the old hand or a new hand?
That's a new hand, Chair.
Thank you very much. You can proceed.
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to ask in relation to when the person has left the act, where the scene of where the act of the domestic violence happened. Now, myself as a victim, I would call the police, but the person left, the person who did the act left. The police comes to assist the person who is the victim, the woman, and makes a charge, and the person gives an affidavit that steps can't they say that steps were taken to arrest? If the person has left the scene of the domestic violence, can't they do something like that in an affidavit? And then I was worried during the public hearings, the concept of self-defense. If the victim does something in self-defense or her child intervenes to protect the victim, now, if all of the people are arrested, I'm not sure if that is still mentioned and where it is mentioned in such a case. And then thirdly, yes, it does come up where a victim has already passed away once the investigation was done and it was found that there was a third person involved. Now, the person is involved in a domestic violence, but the woman passed away and it's already too late. What happens in a situation like that to prevent something like that? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Nibotahan. Any further questions or comments, Honorable Zale?
I'm covered, Chair.
Mr. Roberts, sir?
Mr. Chairperson, one must look at a clause where offence has been committed. That is also an act of domestic violence. I can even go as far as this. If an offence has been committed and the person runs away from the incident of domestic violence, the police can actually, in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, apprehend that person and arrest him. They've got that powers to an extent where they can arrest in terms of Section 41 of the Criminal Procedure Act. I think one of the provisions reads something to the effect that where there's a reasonable suspicion that a person has committed any offence that is listed in Schedule 1, a person can apprehend and arrest such a person without a warrant. So if the person passed away, it's obviously murder, and a suspicious person may be apprehended in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act. I can probably not take it further than that. One must remember the clause specifically specifies, firstly, one, it must be offence. That is also an incident of domestic violence. And further, clause 2, it must be offence containing element of violence, that is also an incident of domestic violence. It's my submission that currently the police do have powers to apprehend a suspect if they a charge has been laid against a person, or if they receive some information or have a reasonable suspicion that an offence was committed by a person who is no longer at the scene of the incident of domestic violence. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chairperson, if I may interject.
Ms. Clark.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think just around the use of the word person and respondent, and particularly with the defence, the self-defence problem, because if you have the word person there, then it could include the complainant. So both the complainant and the respondent could be arrested the way that it currently reads. If one uses the word respondent, then it's only the respondent who may be arrested. But if one's wanting to address a respondent using third parties to abuse the complainant in order to get around the law, one could always extend the definition of domestic violence to be direct or indirect actions, which is being used in the Protection from Harassment Act. And that then allows the use of, or addresses the use of third parties. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, do you still want to engage on this matter? We can proceed, Mr. Robertson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Mr. Romano, on page 37, it's the clause that deals with entering of a private dwelling for purposes of obtaining evidence. It is proposed that the reference to private dwelling, even in the heading, be substituted with a reference to residence. It's like you need to keep the terminology that is used in the bill the same. Dwelling is only used here, but residence is used right through the Domestic Violence Act. So each and every place where dwelling appears, it must be substituted with residence. I'm finished.
Members, any input on Honorable Jalia? Is it a new hand or an old hand?
It's an old hand, Chair. Thank you. Sorry.
Just going to lower it. Thank you very much. Can you proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. It's on page 38. On page 38, that relates to section 4 and its application for a protection order, or the initial application for a protection order. I did indicate previously that we probably need to do away with any provision in the Domestic Violence Act that describes a certain means how you can apply for a protection order. And I did previously indicate that we may delete the proposed subsection 1A. After I considered everything, I think we must at least to an extent mention it to make sure that we get something like a legislative mandate or authorization. They do provide for the online making of applications. The new proposal is indicated in red. And what I propose is that subsection 1 be substituted with the following. Any complainant may in a prescribed form and manner apply to report for a protection order. The reference to form and manner ensures that we can prescribe that electronic applications may be submitted to a court. And then to compensate, or rather to extend or further explain that, a new clause 1B is rather a new section one B is proposed that reads the effect that the application subsection one must first A be lodged with the clerk of the court. That is your physical applications. And then secondly, must be electronically submitted to an electronic address of the court having jurisdiction. Just to clarify that aspects. The next amendment relates to renumbering of the proposed 1B. I'm not going to deal with renumbering yet, but what I intend to insert is that what must be captured on the repository must not just merely be limited to the application. In some instances, other information may also be necessary. So it may be viable to include a reference to any such information as may be prescribed. As just to subvert and embrace this provision. If you go to page 40, it's the next amendment.
Chairperson, before you pass there,
Honorable Mfuka.
Thank you very much, Mr. Robertson. I just want you to go also a little bit up, just go down so that I can look at the part of the jurisdiction as it mentioned there. I want to check because previously, as you have done the amendments, we really have to thank you for that, for physical and also electronic. But on the issue of the jurisdiction, remember there were cases where you find that a person will run away from Cape Town and open up a case in, example, in Eastern Cape or in Gauteng. Then they will tell that person to go back and be at that jurisdiction. Can you clarify me what is going to happen now?
Thank you. First, physical lodgement of the application of the court is the de facto position. The person must, in terms of 1BA, go to the court if she wants to make a physical application. The second one is your electronic application, where you can actually be in Pretoria, where the domestic violence was committed in Cape Town, and you can submit it to electronic address. But the electronic address must be that of the court having jurisdiction to hear the matter. So, yes, electronically you can submit the application even if you elsewhere in the Republic, but obviously it must be submitted at least to the court or the email address or other electronic address of the court that will yield the application. One of the issues is when you deal with domestic violence applications or any litigation, there's a reason why a court in a certain district will have jurisdiction to deal with the matter. That's mainly to ensure that, amongst others, the witnesses is available. The court can issue order only to the extent of the limits of its jurisdiction, geographical jurisdiction in this regard. So there need to be some kind of restriction how far you can go. If the domestic violence is committed in Cape Town and you apply for order in Pretoria, then all the witnesses must come up to Pretoria as well as the respondent. Since you now give jurisdiction to a court where the incident did not occur, and it will prejudice, amongst others, the respondent, witnesses in the state, and must pay witness fees in some instances, etc. My submission is you can, even if you're not in a court, within the jurisdiction of a court, apply electronically. But you must apply to a court that will have jurisdiction to hear the matter. Thank you.
Thank you. There are no further hands.
Honourable Chair, come in.
Ms. Clark.
Thank you, sir. I'd also just like to refer the Honourable Member to Section 12, which deals with jurisdiction, and it's a very broad, in the current Act as it stands, it's very broadly defined, so a person may even physically apply from any area, even though the domestic violence has, for example, happened in Pretoria, they may apply in Cape Town. Yes, there will be perhaps logistical things with regards to if they don't have physical evidence, but they may apply. They're not restricted in terms of the current rules of jurisdiction. And I'm sure Mr. Robertson will get to it, but he's actually even expanded the areas in terms of residence and to studies and that sort of thing in terms of the Section 12. Thank you.
Thank you. There are no further hands. Can we proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. If Mr. Romano can go to the next page, or rather page 40. Stop there. Okay, in terms of the current section, it provides, amongst others, that reapplication for a domestic violence interdict is brought, and where the complainant doesn't bring it in person, but the other person brings it on his or her behalf, the court, or rather the other person, must consent to such application brought on his or her behalf. A proposal that is inserted here relates to children, and it's my submission that in certain instances children is vulnerable, and there must be some provision that allows another person to bring an application on behalf of a child. Not necessarily with the consent of the child. You must take into account that the child lives in a domestic relationship. The child will not, in some instances, consent to the bringing of application on his or her behalf. And although it was in the clause before it was amended, I want to bring that part of the previous clause back that allow other person to apply for domestic violence interdict on behalf of a child without the child's consent or permission. So that is the reason why the A paragraph is inserted. One can extend it to a child who is 16 years of age, 18 years of age. I put down 16 years. It's up to the committee, if they agree with it, the clause, to determine appropriate age for the child. But I also add a qualifier that the court must consider the application to be in the best interest of the child. That is the standard in the Children's Act. Is there any comments on this clause?
Honorable Jala.
Thank you, Chairperson. I hear Mr. Robertson on clause A, is it A? Yes, A, where it says a child who is under the age of 16. If I think that one must stay, that age, it can stay. We agree on that age, but I have a practical example where a 13-year, 14-year child who was raped, who did not want it to be known, you know, that thing happened to her. And such, you know, incidents. Sometimes they create, because at that time, maybe she doesn't feel like it's anything wrong, you know, it's something wrong. And when as an adult, you understand exactly what is happening. So I'm not sure in that case, how can we assist them? Or maybe, I don't know, but I have a practical example. And you find that that child is going to grow up in a manner that maybe she would feel like you exposed her, you told people about this thing, and she did not want that to happen. So I'm not sure. It's my comment. I'm not sure if maybe how can we deal with it, or anybody can comment on that one. Because 16 years, they can speak for themselves. I mean, say 15 years, 14 years, 13 years. Those children, they can speak for themselves, even though the law gives them that latitude of saying they are still children, they are still under our care, but they just speak for themselves. They can hate you as a parent for telling people that, or even more so, reporting it, that thing without their consent to the police. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Jale. Honorable Nibo Trafan.
Yes, thank you, Chair. On page 39, B, I see mentally retarded. We don't use that term anymore. It's politically incorrect in the disability sector. So please put mentally disabled so it's not mentally retarded. But I'm assuming if you mention children here, it covers all children, whether it be children with or without disability. I'm assuming that this will be covered there as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable. Let's go back to the issues raised by Honorable Jale, Mr. Robertson, Ms. Clark.
Oh, Mr. Chairperson, it's like, certain people don't want to have certain facts made known, especially children, to the public. But obviously, must you now, due to the fact that a child endures domestic violence, shut your eyes and say it's fine? If a child cannot make his own decision, you abide by the decision of the child. In any case, regarding the making known of certain information regarding domestic violence protection order, that can be controlled by legislation. I think it's dealt with in the bill later on. I will get to that. But you can deal with it much further, something similar in the Criminal Procedure Act, when you can say that the identity or any information regarding certain proceedings may not be disclosed, because the court can actually put a plug on the distribution of legislation. But like I said, children is very vulnerable. In some instances, they endure domestic violence. That's mainly due to the fact that they have got no other place to live, doesn't have the necessary ripeness to deal with the matter, and to require that such a child must give consent is problematic. You close your eyes to the real problem, especially where other person in a domestic relationship actually wants to help this child.
Thank you. Yes, and if I may just come in there, Chairperson, with your permission. With regard to a child under 13 who's been raped, there's already a mandatory reporting clause in the Sexual Offences Act, Section 54. So all of those sexual offences, there's a mandatory clause to report to the police. So there is no discretion with regards to a sexual offence. With regards to acts of domestic violence, currently the domestic violence only provides you with the protection order is for a child, and the child is defined as someone under the age of 18. This particular clause speaks to, and the child can actually bring an application in their own name, irrespective of age. Obviously, someone would need to support them, but they do have direct access to the court in, irrespective of their age. In this regard, you have the age of 16 that's been proposed, but this might bring interpretational problems. So it may be an option just to revert to child in this case. Naturally, the presiding officer would hear the child's point of view and may then consider whether the child wishes to proceed or not. But it is also dealt with in chambers and not in open court or anything like that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Clark. Ms. Jale, can you lower your hands?
I'll do that.
Thank you very much. Can we proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Mr. Romano, can you go down? Subsection 4 was amended to insert without the consent of the parent or guardian there. I believe it's usually a parent or guardian. In certain instances must provide consent if legal proceedings are to be instituted. Although it's well acknowledged that in terms of the Children's Act, a child may litigate without such permission in certain instances. So just to further clarify this. At the bottom of the place, the page, I excluded, maybe submitted online as prescribed, since provision is already made for the making of online applications elsewhere. You don't need to specifically refer to this manner of making an application. Next page, please. A concern that I want to raise at this stage relates to the capturing of documents on the repository. Right through the Domestic Violence Act, there's a reference that certain historical documents must again be saved on the repository. It's my submission that we should regulate this by regulation to ensure that something like an online portfolio is created and that only new documents must be saved on the portfolio. Just something that we will take into account when we finalize the bill. The next amendment is on page 43. The amendments proposed here is mainly of a drafting nature. Those clause should probably be substituted to ensure that certain actions is structured at the appropriate place in the clause. I'm not going to deal with that, but I'll make a complete redrafting option to cater for all the options that is proposed in the comments on the side. The next amendment that need to be discussed is on page 59. In terms of this provision, That relates to the issuing of a final protection order. One aspect that was not catered for, amongst others, were the return of service. Mr. Romano, page 59, go up. It's 6A, another page up. Okay, stop there. The current provision don't make a provision for the return of service that must be captured. So what I propose is a substitution of the current paragraph B to provide the clerk of the court must capture the final protection order, the warrant of arrest, return of service on the respondent, and a copy of the final protection order and warrant of arrest on a complainant on the integrated repository for protection orders. It's a drafting issue. I think it captures everything and must be done. On page 61, it's clause 6A, the proposed section 6A. Stop. Just go to the beginning of this of section 6A. Just a question that I want to raise is in. I know I redrafted section 6A, but my concern is still the obligation that is imposed on the minister to develop. I would propose that a minister be substituted with a director general. He's, in any case, the person in control of the department that must ensure that the repository is developed. Is there any views on this specifically?
Members, would you have a violent objection to substitution of the minister with the teacher, Honorable Mufuke?
Chairperson, thank you very much. I think I agree with that because the problem is that if it's a DG, somebody who will actually be doing the handover at some stage to somebody. But when it comes to minister, some things are lost in the process. And I agree with this one. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Is it a different view? I think we agree. You can substitute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. On page 63, it relates to section 7 of the bill. Thank you. I must point out, we must take into account, depends how we're going to deal with domestic violence. If a related person is regarded as a separate form of domestic violence, not per se against the complainant, or if we deal with a related person domestic violence, which is also considered domestic violence against the complainant, we may need to deal with or redraft certain provisions or insert new provisions in the proposed section 7.1. Although paragraph F, entering the complainants or related person workplace or studies, although it's deleted, it should not be considered as deleted. It must be retained. In any case, even if the option of related person abuse is allowed, a court must be able to make certain orders where the respondent is prohibited from committing certain conduct against a related person. Paragraph H is merely redrafting, rather a drafting correction. It's nothing new. I'm not going to discuss that. On page 64, it's paragraph 5A. 5A. What is inserted here is contact details of a complainant or related person. Currently it only reads work or home address, but obviously essentially you must also prohibit the making available of certain contact details, electronic contact details like email address or the cell phone number of a complainant. In paragraph C, we're right through the specific subsection. The text is corrected to deal with this. The next major amendment is that on page 67. It relates to section 8. Correct, stop. Stop the down. Just want to extend the measures that must be taken into account by a member of the South African Police Service. Currently, it's only limited, amongst others, to risk, safety, health, or well-being of the complainant. Obviously, damage of property is something that must also be taken into account, like damaging the complainant's car or any other conduct that amounts to damage of property as is defined. So I propose the inclusion of damage to property in the considerations that must be taken into account, whether to arrest the respondent or whether not to arrest the respondent. On page 69, it relates to section 9.1. That relates to... Stop. Okay, this is where a firearm may be seized. What I want to do is to extend paragraph A to also include any other person. Currently it's restricted to threats by the respondent that intend to kill, injure himself, herself, any person in a domestic relationship or a related person. I don't think it will harm if we insert or any other person and not necessarily restricted to the categories of persons mentioned in that paragraph. At page 71.
Before you move, there is a hand, Honorable Mpuke. Is it an old hand, Honorable Mpuke?
No. Thanks, Chairperson. I was saying that I think on the one of the family or related person or any other person, I think I will agree with that, because sometimes when women get protection orders and the finality of it, when it's finalized, most of them are not even killed by the very same partners or related person. They send somebody else. So that is something for me that I think it's proper that it should be now there, because we still have to be discussing on the monitoring of after getting a protection order. It should not be like you got it and it's done. How do we monitor on that? Because research has shown that most women are killed immediately after getting the protection orders.
Thank you very much. Can we proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson. On page 73, I think that is the next major amendment, which I do want to discuss. It relates to service of documents. Previously, in the bill, in the proposed section 4, there was comments, or there were provision that to the effect that where complainant and the respondent share the same residence, documents must be served in person on the parties. This is inserted as a clause B. And then the current clause B is renumbered to clause C. The new proposal that must be considered is to the effect that in terms of the clause, a court may, if it's satisfied that the service of any document cannot be effected in the prescribed manner, the court may make an order allowing service to be effected in the form and manner specified in the order. The renumbered clause C, or the aforementioned clause, if you can just, okay, provides per se for electronic service. It's my submission that electronic service has got various shortcomings. And the de facto position must still be that first, there must be service as may be prescribed, which is usually physical service on a place or on a person. And only if physical service doesn't work that one may resort to electronic service. Big problem with electronic service is, are you going to provide a return of service to send a protection order to somebody's, let's call it Gmail address, doesn't mean that a person actually received that document. You cannot ensure that service did take place. So my submission is the bill must, as a first option, always try to recognize physical service, and only in instances where physical service doesn't work, that the court may make an order to effect that documents may be prescribed and may be served in a prescribed manner, which will include electronic service. I would like to hear the comments of the committee on this specifically. It's a problematic aspect.
Members?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Can I note their hands? It's Honorable Ngola, Honorable Mofuke,
thanks, Chair.
Yes.
No, I just want to check that, with this form of service, how do we then account for the return of service?
Thank you, Honorable Ngora. Honorable Mfuke.
Thank you, Chair. I think I'm covered by Honorable Ngola because I wanted to find out on that, especially after the explanation of Mr. Roberts, which is true that upon failing, then you can go electronically, but even electronically you can still fail. Then what is the next option?
Thank you very much.